This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, California Governor Jerry Brown is here to talk about how states are acting independently from Washington on climate change, clean energy, and other issues. But first, it has been a busy and confusing week in Washington, with leaks of instructions to several government science agencies, including the FDA and the Department of Health and Human Services, to refrain from releasing information or making statements without administration approval. Here to explain some of the restrictions and whether there's anything that agency workers can do under existing scientific integrity policies is Maggie Kurth Baker, senior science reporter at 538.com. She's at NPR. NPR, welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
There's been a lot of back and forth over these restrictions on science agencies speaking to the public. Where do things stand now?
So this is a really complicated story, and it's kind of become clear that nobody has all the details and that the details keep changing. But like you said, at least some agencies were told that they couldn't communicate with the public through tweets or blogs or publishing reports. And a few agencies had information about climate change taken down off of their websites. And the APA is under a big review of their agency's contracts and grants. Now, a lot of this is temporary, and much of it is also just an expanded version of the kind of slowdowns you see at federal agencies anytime there's a presidential transition. But there are a couple of things that I think it's important to draw attention to. First off, you know, some of these restrictions on public communication, they might be violating the Obama-era scientific integrity policies that at least 26 agencies have. But it turns out that those policies are completely violatable. You know, they aren't statute. They can be ignored without any real consequence. And that's something that probably should have been paid attention to earlier. You know, in Canada, for instance, government scientists had these kind of protections written into their contracts. So they can't just be told not to communicate with the public. That's something their contract says they have to have the freedom to do. The other thing that I think is really important is that it turns out that scientists are censoring themselves. The CDC canceled a climate change conference, and they canceled another conference on the health of LGBT youth. And they did that totally on their own initiative. Nobody told them to. So there have been several things like this. And if you think that the administration's censorship is a big problem, this kind of self-censorship looks like it might be just as big of a threat right now.
But is that self-censorship out of fear?
Yeah, absolutely. But self-censorship out of fear, you know, that's something that matters. And if you're making those choices before somebody tells you to, that's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there are actually plans for scientists to march on Washington. Are there any details about that?
I haven't seen a lot of details about that yet. The March for Scientists has said that they are going to be putting out a date sometime soon. But that's about where things stand. There are hundreds of thousands of people who have, you know, friended their Facebook group. So a lot of people are watching this.
And yeah, from their Facebook page, there are over 100,000 likes already.
Yeah. It seems like it's going to be a big thing if it does get off the ground.
So there is nowhere anybody to go to sign up to join yet because there are no details.
Yeah, I mean, other than following the Facebook page, it seems like that is probably the most effective way to keep track of what's going on.
Last time I looked, it's a private one, so we'll have to see if that expands. we usually do good thing, bad thing after your segment, but you have some good news and bad news about cancer rates, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the good news is that fewer Americans die from cancer today than they did back in 1980. Between then and 2014, the death rate from cancer declined by 20%. So that's great.
That's great. So how could be bad news about?
Well,
give it
so
to
the
us
bad
slowly.
News. Yeah. The bad news is that decline was not evenly distributed across the entire nation. You know, it's mostly benefiting people on the coasts and in the Intermountain West, so Colorado, Nevada. Meanwhile, death rates from cancer rose by 20% to up to 46% in parts of Appalachia. And you have specific types of cancers in specific places that are also on the rise. So there's been an increase in fatal kidney cancer in Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. And liver cancer death rates have risen everywhere. Scientists say that probably the biggest thing we're seeing here is the effects of lowered smoking rates out on the coasts, cutting back on the amount of lung cancer.
So you have the other cancer rates rising comparison.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a new study that says our understanding of what asteroids are may be faulty. Like, wow, what they're like. Tell us about
that. Yeah. Well, so it's been a really big week for asteroids. Space rocks, they're doing great in the news. You had an asteroid the size of a bus that passed between us and Mars us and the moon on Tuesday. And then this paper came out. And this paper is showing that a lot of the meteorite debris that scientists use to study the composition and formation of our solar system might actually just be the detritus of a single massive asteroid collision in space some 460 million years ago. And that matters because it means that our data is probably skewed. So, for instance, the debris that we're finding a lot on Earth, it doesn't look very much like the asteroids that are in our solar system's asteroid belts.
Huh. So what does that mean for our understanding about the asteroids?
Well, it means that we need to kind of start paying attention to the asteroid debris that we have on Earth that is outside the norm, because that might actually be telling us more about what our solar system is really like.
Finally, you have a story about a specialized sort of foreign worker hunting snakes in Florida. Wow.
Yeah,
sounds kind of dangerous.
It does. I mean, Florida sounds kind of dangerous sometimes. So
we love you, Florida. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we know that Florida has this problem with people getting, you know, baby pet pythons and then releasing them into the swamp. And then these things get overgrown and they breed. And now there's all these pythons all over the place in Florida. So they've had in the past these contests to try to catch pythons.
Yeah.
And last year, 1,000 American hunters took a month to bag 106 snakes, which is not bad. But recently, Florida brought in a couple of professional snake catchers from India. And these two guys, caught 14 snakes in 2 weeks, including a 16-foot-long female that was living in the old Nike missile base.
Wow. Well, they're pretty good. There's a company. Two guys get snakes. You know, that sort of
Guys get snakes. And they're going to be here for 2 months total with a couple of translators. And it's also sort of mind-blowing to me how little they're being paid. So all four of those people are being paid less than $70,000.
Wow.
That's kind of amazing.
They're going to get a lot of business, I think. Thank you, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you.
Maggie Kurth-Baker, senior science reporter at 538.com. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Smartphones have changed all aspects of our lives, right, including how we exercise. Back in the day, I'm talking to the era of jazzercise, water aerobics, remember all of those? Finding the right exercise class or trainer could be a tough thing. But now, the perfect workout buddy is right in your pocket or strapped to your arm. All sorts of apps can help with your exercise routine, but how does using your smartphone really affect your training? My next guest is here to work out. Get it? The good and the bad of hitting the gym with your phone in hand. Michael Rebold is the program director of Integrative Exercise Science at Hiram College in Hiram, Ohio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, nice to be on.
Now, our phones are with us all the time. Sometimes you can't help but bring it. What are some of the ways our phone can help us, the good thing, while we're working out?
All right. So first off, we know that using our cell phone for listening to music increases our exercise intensity. So if we exercise and have it and exercise at a higher intensity, we're going to have a higher caloric expenditure. So that's one benefit of using our cell phone while working out is listening to music with it. And then also music kind of drowns out our heavy respiration, sweating that's associated with exercise, allowing us to somewhat enjoy exercise more and exercise for longer durations as well, so also leading to greater caloric expenditure.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I recognize that. I have good music, you know. I know that a good beat going.
As long as you have a good tempo, it's going to increase that exercise intensity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you looked at specifically how texting and talking and trip you up on a treadmill. What did you find? It was not very, good news, was it?
Yeah, so two common things that we use our cell phone for are texting and talking. So while utilizing your cell phone for those two purposes, we found in one study that it does decrease your exercise intensity But in a more recent study, we found out that it does also decrease your balance. So if you use your cell phone for texting while working out, it's going to decrease your balance up to 45%. And then if you use it for talking, 19%. So both are significant because if we do decrease our balance while exercising, this can increase our risk for injuries. And obviously not a good thing. It can lead to knee sprains, ankle sprains, more significant injuries, those types of things. So texting, talking while using the cell phone really distracts us from exercising and predisposes us to significant injuries possibly.
You know, if it's almost 50-50 and you're balancing that texting, you're going to fall off that machine.
Yep, exactly. It's with the cell phone, we're so in tune with it. So if we get a text or if we're talking with someone, we're more interested in that conversation and not that exercise bout that's going on. So we shift our attention to the cell phone and we forget what we're doing. So we could possibly, if we're on the treadmill, fall off of the treadmill and hurt ourselves.
Yeah, it just takes a fraction of a second.
It just takes a half a second, and there you go.
You're gone. We know, of course, that exercise is part physical and it is part mental. Do you know how using our smartphones affects the cognitive benefits?
Yep. So I just recently completed a study looking at cell phone use, once again, texting and talking, and examined how it affected our cognition during an aerobic bout of exercise. So we know engaging in aerobic exercise, we have this release of neurotransmitters like endorphins, increased blood flow to the brain, therefore enhancing our cognition. And preliminary findings from this study found that if you're going to use your phone while engaging in an aerobic bout of exercise for texting and talking actually blunts these cognitive benefits from actually happening.
All right. Well, we'll make sure we're not texting and talking on that treadmill. Thank you very much, Michael Rebold, Program Director of Integrative Exercise Science at Hiram College in Hiram, Ohio. After the break, Governor Jerry Brown on the real facts on climate change and what states can do about that and other science and tech issues. No alternative facts here. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As we were hearing earlier, the new administration hasn't shown much love for government science. The Trump White House has told scientists at the EPA they may now have to have their studies reviewed on a, quote, case-by-case basis before sharing their findings with the public. Several national parks, including Badlands National Park, tweeted out a flurry of facts about climate change, only to have those facts scrubbed from the accounts. No matter what the president thinks about global warming, and he says lately he's keeping an open mind to it, at least one governor is not treating it as a hoax perpetuated by the Chinese.
We can't fall back and give in to the climate deniers. The science is clear. The danger is real.
California Governor Jerry Brown speaking in his State of the State address this week. Governor Brown joins me now to talk about that and other science and technology issues facing his state and the nation. He's at the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Welcome to Science Friday, Governor Brown.
Well, thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
You know, I heard your whole State of the State address, and it's very, very forceful, more than any that I've heard you do or any other governor recently.
Well, I'm glad you're following. It's forceful because the occasion calls for that. The stimulus is of great magnitude. What we're talking about is not business as usual. It's not just one thing after another. We're facing existential threats. Catastrophe, it does loom. And I'm not just talking about climate change, habitat destruction. I'm talking about the threat of nuclear war, the doomsday clock put out by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, an organization that was founded in part by Albert Einstein after World War II, has moved the doomsday clock to 2.5 minutes before the end, which is midnight. And there are other threats. And basically, the sense of urgency that I have derives from my perception that the world leaders in a rather accurate sense are goofing off. They're not talking to one another at the highest levels about the most important threats: climate change, nuclear incident, accident, nuclear terrorism, nuclear mistake, nuclear war regionally, North Korea, many, many risks, as well as other risks. The great British scientist, who was chief scientist for Great Britain, Martin Rees, said a few years ago that he thought that the chance of humanity lasting to the end of the century, that's another 83 years, was only about 50%. So I think it's time not to panic in any sense, but to demand that our leaders wake up, acknowledge the threats that human power and human technology now portend and now have within our hands, and do something about it. And yes, I did speak urgently at my State of the State address, and I did mention all these major the threats to affordable health care, to climate change, to undocumented people who are living in our state and the country. But I also mentioned the possibility of financial meltdown, still a possibility, the issue of climate change, and then the matter of nuclear incident, which mm-hmm. doesn't get the same treatment. But I do think that these larger threats are the fundamental responsibility of the president of China, of Russia, of the United States, key European leaders, and they're not dealing with it. They're really averting their gaze, and that is dangerous, very dangerous.
Do you think, let me give out my number first, 844-724-8255 to talk with Governor Brown, and also you can tweet us at Cy Fry. Do you then think that states like California can effectively take the bit in its own mouth and, you know, and go at this alone in trying to find the path to the future without Washington's cooperation?
Well, obviously, we need Washington's cooperation, but we can do things. First of all, we can raise awareness of the issue, which is very important, although I think there's a reluctance on the part of the media to ever consider these more catastrophic threats. I guess that's bad for advertising or just doesn't fit with our conventional level of comfort that people seem to demand. So I do think that governors, senators, mayors, to a lesser extent, can speak to the important existential issues that are facing humanity. Secondly, I do think that we can do things. Cities can improve their efficiency. California has not only at 28% renewable electricity, we have a whole range of greenhouse reduction actions that are in place and are escalating over time. In addition, we've started, with the help of some German parliamentarians, to we fashioned the Under 2 MOU, committing the signatories to reducing greenhouse gases to no more than 2 tons per person by 2050, committing to do everything we can to keep the temperature from rising more than 2 degrees centigrade past the beginning of the industrial age. We have upwards of 165 signatories. I think we're going to have 200 before long. It includes countries such as Germany. We have Chile, who has endorsed it. We have other countries. We have provinces. We have Quebec. We have British Columbia. We have the state of Washington, Oregon. We have regions, states, and provinces representing over 1 billion people. So, yes, we're doing something locally. We're doing something globally. And in our democratic society, power is not contained totally at the top, but always has the possibility of exploding and bursting out from below in the hearts of people. And yes, we can, we should, and we must do everything we can at local and regional levels.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. We noted earlier in the program that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention abruptly canceled the plan, the summit it had on climate change. It had been planning for months and is no longer happening. And former Vice President Al Gore said he's going to be hosting his own summit change conference. Are these sort of local, we'll do it if you don't do it sort of ideas?
Well, yes. And I think that the text that I might cite here is an essay that Vaclav Havel wrote in the early, late 70s. It was really actually put into English in the 80s, called The Power of the Powerless. And he talked about how a rock band in Czechoslovakia could present a challenge to the system and a charter that many writers and artists signed in Czechoslovakia began the undermining of that totalitarian system. And when we face, as we do today, not what I would call totalitarian government, but a government that is playing fast and loose with the truth, which is not demonstrating the respect for honest communication that democracy absolutely depends on, then we need the people themselves to live in the truth, to demand the truth. And that in itself undermines those who do the opposite. And right now that appears to be what's going on. And it isn't just one person called the president. We've got an entire congressional majority that refuses to live in the truth regarding climate change. We have many leaders who are not living in the truth of the nuclear danger and how the trillion-dollar buildup that was proposed by President Obama and now apparently being carried on by President Trump is extremely dangerous, is not security building, but just the opposite. So we have the compelling, I'd say absolute need for everyone who has a voice to speak in the truth, because there's nothing more powerful than the truth. The truth has a energy and an ability to expose and to take down the falsehoods and the evasions that are coming not just out of Washington, but out of Europe, out of Eastern Europe, out of Russia, out of China, wherever. And it becomes absolutely more important for programs such as this, for scientists all over the world, to speak the truth as they know it and thereby combat the error and the falsity that is spreading like a cancerous plague all over the world.
You know, scientists are beginning to speak up. I remember, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. I remember the environmental movement, the anti-Vietnam movement. It sort of feels a little bit like the 60s, does it not to you, Governor?
Well, these are always historical. This is an historical comparison you're making. So
yes.
That you can judge or interpret in various ways. I don't know. The time of the Vietnam War, where America was, you know, pounding the Vietnamese and we were engaged there. I mean, there's a lot of things. I don't know whether it might be helpful, but I would just say this. Let's just look at where we are. The science is getting clearer and clearer. Just in the last week, a report came out that instead of a possible 6 feet rise in sea level, it's plausible that it could go to 8 feet. Well, that's completely devastating to millions of people, a good slice of our economic strength in America as well as around the world. So there's a lot of truth that we're accessing, and yet there's so much error, falsehood, and evasion that is being communicated by our leaders. And I mean, you have a Republican Party that is sworn to deny climate change. It's incredible. And I think the nuclear threat in some ways is even more immediate because it's a danger at any moment that could mm-hmm. that could materialize. So we definitely need those of science, people of prestige, churches, people from whatever walk of life that has the public megaphone, that have the public megaphone to speak out and speak out as forcefully as they can.
Last weekend, among those gathering in Washington for the Women's March, there were a number of scientists, and our contributor, Emily Driscoll, caught up with a group of them, and it is really interesting what some of them had to say, speaking about mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'd like to play a clip from that now.
Stand for science! Stand for science! Stand for science! Stand for science!
My sign says science matters, climate change is real. My name's Ann Ellixhauser. I'm a health services researcher. I work for the federal government. And I'm afraid of what's going to happen in the government. I can't even hardly talk because I'm so emotional about this, but there are so many reasons to be out here. The denial of science, the distortion of truth, and with basically just shutting down truth on the internet. You know, we're worried about the information that we're putting out there just being taken down.
I'm Bill Hayden, and I work at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. And half of the work that we do there is earth science. The other half is planetary and cosmological science. And of course, the earth science half of what we do, that community is very worried that this administration is going to not only block the information, but discontinue funding it.
That's two people who were at the Women's March, two scientists, and Alexa Hauser and Bill Hayden at the Women's March in Washington last weekend. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm talking with Governor Jerry Brown. One of the things that scientists, as you heard, the governor, there are worried about is cutting off NASA's funding for Earth research, Earth science. I mean, they do so much of it right now, and it's such an important work. It just seems hard to believe that could happen.
Well, it is. But, darkness cannot totally extinguish the light. And certainly the light of science is something that most people understand or at least respect and are open to its basic axioms and points. I think of the battle hymn of the Republic and that key line. In fact, I used it in my speech. His truth is marching on. Truth is marching on. And no matter how much the politicians, who don't enjoy that much credibility in the media or in the minds of the public, if you look at trust levels and confidence, they're relatively low. Scientists have a higher degree of credibility than most of our elected leaders. So I think there's great opening. There's fear, there's trepidation. But I think we should have confidence that if we live in integrity, if we say what we know, we admit what we don't know, and we advance from that perspective, the movement will grow. And the prophets of error and falsehood and lies will be vanquished. Of that, I have no doubt.
Let me see if I can get a phone call or two. Let's go to Lander, Wyoming. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Mr. Governor. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I have a question. As someone who's relatively involved in politics, I've written many letters to my state senators and representatives, to the governor. I appreciate the governor's concern for the world and with world leaders, but what is it? Do you have any advice for those of us who are civilians on the ground? What can we do to kind of to bring these issues to light in our own circle of influence?
Mm-hmm. Governor.
Well, I'd start with your city. Depending upon where you live, there are environmental measures, whether it's recycling, whether it's energy efficiency. There are examples of tremendous waste that are all part of the generation of unneeded greenhouse gases. They're not only unneeded, they're actually detrimental. So I would say work with the city, your local city councilman, your local supervisor, and see what can be done. Find out what other cities have done. There are cities all over this country. The mayors have their own organization and task force in dealing with renewable energy, energy efficiency. Those things you can start at the local level. You can hold meetings. You can have committees of correspondence like we did during the Revolutionary War. You got to start somewhere. You got to meet a letter. Can seem like a small thing, but meetings with the social media, with action at the local level, all that will build. We're in a moment where you're not alone. People all over America, in fact, all over the world, are seeing the threats and the same reality. And I'm telling you, it's building. Democracy is a spirit of the people. It is a power of the people. And start locally, and it will spread globally.
Talking as my guest with the California Governor Jerry Brown, we're going to take a short break and take more of your calls. Come back talking with the governor. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. You can also leave us a note on our website at sciencefriday.com or on Facebook, and we'll check in there and see what kind of comments you have and get you into the mix. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climate change, clean energy, and nuclear holocaust, the political side of science, with my guest, California Governor Jerry Brown, who is telling us that this is a movement that's growing, that people are getting involved. Let's see if we can get some people get involved. Our number on our phone line, if you'd like to give us a call, 844-724-8255. Governor, I want to play another clip from your State of the State address that sort of was on a whole different tack, but quite interesting.
The president of the state has firm intention to build and build big. And in fact, he met with several labor leaders yesterday and committed to a $1 trillion investment in public works across America. And I say, amen to that, man. Amen to that, brother. We're there with you.
Governor, what are the odds of that actually happening?
I think it's not as easy as the president's made it sound, but very important. He talks, and others talk about the devastation on wage levels because of imports. The bulwark of good American jobs is domestic investment and building roads and tunnels and dams and recycling plants, transportation systems, rail, high speed, local rail, all that is very important. Money well spent. You spend it in a year or two, it can last 100 years or longer. So, yeah, that the infrastructure, I think we can all rally around. Now, some of the Republicans poo-poo that and don't want to spend the money, but they seem to be doing what Trump tells them. And he appears very committed to that. I spoke with one of the labor leaders that was there. He was very enthusiastic that these high-paying union jobs would be forthcoming from this Trump-led investment. So I say on that, let us work together, even while we're having to raise the real sound of alarm about his unwillingness to face climate change or the dangers of nuclear or tearing up the safety net in terms of health care and other things.
Let's go to the phones to San Antonio, Texas. Let's go to Linda in San Antonio. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is kind of an anecdotal thing. We've done this over the years many times in our house. We'll be using some glue or something like that, and it says, this product contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause birth defects. And then we laugh and we go, oh, it's a good thing we don't live in California, you know. I mean, but in reality, there's a sort of nagging feeling that we have sometimes, you know, that, hey, maybe in California they care more about their people and, you know, they're doing some more science research to make sure about the safety of things. And so I just wanted to say that, you know, sometimes in Texas, you know, we're pro-business and we're proud of that, but it kind of feels like there's nobody watching out for the people. And so I just want to say I appreciate what Governor Brown is doing, and I think people do across the country notice it.
Well, you're talking about a voter measure that was passed by the people of California many years ago that requires that if there's a certain level of carcinogen, cancer-causing or which would cause a birth defect, that has to be put, that has to be, a label has to be fixed to the product, whether it's wine or food or even a store where you might go in. So that is important. And given the fact there's over 70,000 different chemicals in the stream of commerce, in the air, the water, the soil, we don't know what actually triggers mutations. And everybody's different. And some people are sensitive to one chemical. Other people are sensitive to another. And at what level? So the thing to remember is that human beings in the last 200 years have accumulated vast power. The technological impact on nature, on the human body, is growing. If you think of it as a curve, the power curve is going straight up. Now, the wisdom curve of how to deal with all this impact and power of our modern technology, that's a flat curve. That's not going up. And that creates a gap between the power to destroy and the wisdom to control those destructive forces. So, yes, there's good in science, fabulous wealth and good and well-being, but there's the dark side of all that, and we need the insight mm-hmm. and the wisdom and, yes, the science to uncover all the aspects of what we're doing so we can act prudentially mm-hmm. and wisely instead of this rather kind of will-o'-the-wisp. If it's new, it's good, let's do mm-hmm. it. And then we're going to find out after the fact when it's too late that we've created a horror.
I think the caller's larger message was that, you know, the idea of so goes California, so goes the rest of the country. And she was saying that California acts as a model for other parts of the country. Are you getting support after your State of the State and other calls for sort of an independent way from other governors, other like-minded governors who are with you?
Well, there's no doubt there's a real response to what I said. In fact, I was in a restaurant a couple of nights ago, and the whole place erupted in applause. And I think that is not so much me as it is the fear of what people are seeing coming out of Washington and my words that we are going to defend California. And when we do, because we're such a vital part of America, we're defending the country itself. So California is a force. I don't want to overstate it, but I think this footnote would be, I think, would be well to note. California was Republican under many administrations, and we had a governor who unmercifully attacked immigrants, undocumented people who'd come here, and we have a few million, by the way, who are working and contributing to our state. Well, that assault on what is now a very large percentage of the people, if not undocumented, at least of Latino or Hispanic descent, it's now 40%, that completely turned the state around. And I would say the extremism of the Republican majority and other interest groups that have temporarily taken hold of Washington are reducing to an absurd level the conservative cause. And there will be a backlash. And that backlash will be similar to the backlash that came in California that essentially swept out the extreme Republican position. They may come back in a more intelligent and moderate guise. But I would say that the Republicans in Congress are flirting with real political danger by their uncritically accepting the nonsense, the lies, and the dangerous policies that are now being espoused.
You know, looking into the future, this is an interesting place because I wanted to go to sort of sum up here. Your accomplishments, going back to the 70s, you sponsored the first ever tax incentive for rooftop solar. You put in place the country's first energy efficiency standards for buildings and appliances. You proposed a solar-powered space satellite to provide solar energy for the planet. I mean, this was visionary stuff back then, all of which have been copied and proven successful, except for that solar energy satellite, which we're still waiting for, but you don't know. I want to ask you now, if you look into the crystal ball 30, 40 years from now, what do you see there?
Looking how far out do you want
me
to look?
As far as you'd like to look.
Well, look, we don't know the future. That's one thing. We're not prophets. I would say that, and I say this optimistically, that common sense prevails. We have enough free media that the truth can seep out and disseminate to a critical mass of people that can turn this current regime around or replace it with a more thoughtful, more sensitive, and more truthful group of leaders. So I'm hopeful. I do think it could be a close call here because we're building up such power in the industrial impact on natural systems, on the soil, on habitat, on all the constituent elements that makes our life possible. We're tearing away at that, as well as in some respects improving it. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot to do. The risks are very serious, but the tools are at hand. And in California, we do have laboratories, we have great universities, we have great science, we have Google, we have Facebook, we have Intel, we have all these different innovative enterprises. and we have, a high level of consciousness mm-hmm. among the people. So I'm not going to tell you what the future is, but I can tell you California is closer to what it should be than some of the other parts of the country and the world, and we're going to do everything we can to stay on track.
Governor Brown, I want to thank you very much for taking time to join us today, and good luck, and happy to have you back anytime you want to talk about other new things. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. The new movie Hidden Figures, about unheralded women mathematicians, again focuses the question on why aren't there more women in science and math? Well, some new insight has surfaced. New research finds that girls as young as 6 or 7 start to believe that, quote, being really, really smart is for boys, not for girls, and it may be costing them educational opportunities, career choices, and more. That study was published in the journal Science. Here to talk about these recent findings is a co-author, Dr. Sarah Jane Leslie, philosophy professor, founding director of Princeton University's program in cognitive science. She's based in Princeton, New Jersey. Welcome to Science Friday.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Let's talk about the study. How do we know what girls think about their gender's capacity for brilliance?
Well, the way that we tested the kids in our study was that we looked at 5, 6, and 7-year-old children. And what we did in the first part of our study was just tell these kids a story about someone that we knew who was really, really smart. And we made sure that this story was told in a way that there were no gender clues whatsoever. So there were no pronouns or no other factors that would identify the gender of the person we were talking about. We then showed them 4 pictures of individuals that they had never seen before, either 2 men and 2 women, or if we were talking about children, 2 boys and 2 girls. We then just asked them, which of these people do you think is the person I was talking about in my story? And what we found was that for 5-year-olds, girls and boys were just as likely to pick a member of their own gender as being that person who was the really smart one in the story. But by the time girls and boys reach age 6, we find that girls are significantly less likely than boys to identify a member of their own gender as the protagonist in the story. Another way of putting it is that if we compare 5-year-old girls to 6-year-old girls, we find that the 6-year-olds are much less likely than the 5-year-old girls to identify a girl as the one who can be really smart.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Sarah Jane Leslie. What happens in that 1 year?
Well, a year is a very long time in a young child's life, and they're sensitive to all sorts of social cues around them. Unfortunately, little kids are like sponges that soak up stereotypes. We think that very often adult cues will not be picked up on by children, that they're too subtle. But children will hone right in on them. If we look to popular culture to see how brilliant people are portrayed, we have examples such as Sherlock Holmes, Dr. House, Will Hunting from that movie, mm-hmm. Good Will Hunting, all portrayed as effortlessly brilliant and overwhelmingly male. These are the sorts of cues little kids, even as young as 6, can pick up on.
You know, I went to see the film Hidden Figures. I saw it in an early matinee, and I was pleasantly surprised to see how many girls and kids were in watching that movie.
That's fantastic. I think if we want to diversify science, we need to expose girls to these sorts of role models. In another part of our research, we wanted to see whether or not these stereotypes actually impact girls, and so whether it could be contributing to these gender imbalances in math and science. And to look at that, we asked kids about their interest in a completely novel activity, a game. And for the first part of the study, we described this game as being for kids who are really hardworking. We said only hardworking kids can be good at this game. And there we found no gender difference, boys and girls equally enthusiastic about that game. And then everything else was the same, but we just changed the wording ever so slightly. We said to kids, this game is only for kids who are really, really smart. Only smart kids can be good at this game. And there we found that by the age of 6, little girls were much less enthusiastic than boys about that game, much more motivated to engage with it. When we look to society more generally, the sorts of scientific and mathematical endeavors portrayed in a film like Hidden Figures, we see those sorts of activities as being portrayed as for very smart people. These cumulative effects of young girls being less likely to want to engage with activities that are seen as for smart people lead to cumulative gender imbalances over time.
Hmm. You found that boys and girls were equally interested in tasks that were for really hardworking kids. Can something positive come from this?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we were very heartened to see that when the same activity was just described as being for hardworking kids, boys and girls were equally enthusiastic about it. And more generally, work by Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck and her colleagues has suggested that really everyone benefits from emphasizing the need for hard work, dedication, and skill development. This sort of cultural myth that some people are just effortlessly brilliant isn't helpful, it's not productive, it's also not realistic. People who succeed in math and science work incredibly hard at it, and they get to where they are by really sticking with it. Sending kids those sorts of messages, I think, points the way towards really rectifying this issue and broadening the horizons that our little girls can see.
So don't assume that, well, you don't have any innate traits to be a scientist. Don't say that kind of language.
Exactly. Don't say anything that suggests that only a certain kind of person can be a scientist. Don't say anything that suggests only innately brilliant people can be scientists. Let's talk about the process of science. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the hard work, effort, and dedication that goes into it.
Dr. Leslie, thank you very much. Very interesting study, something we should keep talking about. Sarah Jane Leslie, philosophy professor at Princeton, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. One last thing before you go. Did you enjoy our conversation about the cosmos with Carlo Rovelli last week? Well, then check out our new web feature on the multiverse, the idea that infinite universes spread out beyond our own. Is it a fascinating idea, or is it just a multi-mess? Decide for yourself at sciencefriday.com/multiverse. That's sciencefriday.com/multiverse. Charles Berquist is our director. Senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Kate Heiler. Sorry, Katie. And Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You want to write us? Send us an email to scifry@sciencefriday.com. Go to our website or tweet us or anything, anywhere on social communities. We're there all week. It's not just Friday anymore. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.